Welcome to the Old Testament Story Hour. My name is Hans Spaltholz, and I'll be leading a series of discussions on three of the so-called festival scrolls in the Old Testament. Tonight we're going to be looking at the book of Ruth. I've listed the book of Esther. I've listed the five festivals in the Jewish calendar in which the five books that we could be looking at are read. Song of Solomon is read during Passover. Ruth is read during Pentecost. The ninth of Ab is the day when Jerusalem was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. And that's when Lamentations is read. And for us, what's very interesting is that Holocaust now is commemorated on that day as well. And I think that's when Lutheran churches, roughly at that time, also set aside a Sunday for commemorating and reflecting about Holocaust. Then Booths, which is the fall harvest festival, is when Ecclesiastes is read. And Purim, in February, March, is when the book of Esther is read and the festival is celebrated. As a little start, I wanted to ask you if you've had any kind of experience with Esther. How many of you know the story, basically? Okay. How many of you have read the book, read it recently? Recently. How many of you have ever heard a sermon on Esther? Terrific. How many of us preachers have ever preached a sermon on Esther? Good. Okay. How many of you have studied it in Bible class ever? Okay, thank you. This is mainly for us to see what kinds of experiences we've had with this book. Have any of you ever seen a play presented? Mordecai, Haman, Esther. Okay. Pardon?
A movie.
I don't know about it. Have any of you read the novel by Ray Stedman called The Queen and I? It's an allegorical interpretation coming out of the more neo-evangelical circles of the book, which someone had once read and said that I should take out time to read it. I haven't had the chance yet, but... Okay, well, we've had some interesting instances here of how we as a community, I would say, illustrate one of the intriguing problems about this book, namely, what is it doing in the Bible? From the earliest times, there were questions about whether Esther should be in the Bible or not, both by Jews and by Christians. We'll get into that in a little more. I want to give you one quote from Luther, which indicates where he stood on it. This is from his table talk. I am so hostile to this book, Second Maccabees, and to Esther, that I could wish they did not exist at all. For they Judaize greatly and have much pagan impropriety. This is quite different from what the medieval Jewish scholar Maimonides felt. Namely, he ranked it next to the Pentateuch in importance. So that's a terrific range. What I meant about us as a group illustrating the canonical problem, we in effect make it almost, let's say, questionable by the fact that we don't treat it seriously with a lot of attention. We, in effect, almost exclude it in practice. So the question arises, what is it doing in the scripture? And I want to pun on that a little bit, like we might say, does it really belong there? And then after we deal with that a bit, I'd like to move on to a second question, and that is, assuming that it does belong there, then we might say, what is it doing there? How is it functioning there? But before we get into that, I thought it would be fun to review it briefly. Most of you know that the book takes its name from a beautiful and courageous young Jewish woman married to a king who in that position was able to rescue her whole people from a disastrous extermination plan. Now, what I'd like to do is to kind of retell the story a little bit so that we get a flavor of the experience of the story as a story. It has quite a bit of suspense, lots of irony in it, and by and large, I think it's a very interesting and a delightful story. You could almost start it out as we do stories. Once upon a time, there was, in the days of the great King Ahasuerus, as the book puts it, or Xerxes the First, as we know him, once upon a time in his reign, he gave a lavish banquet, as he was accustomed to. In this case, for all of the people who were directly involved with government in his city, where he was at the time, his winter palace in Susa, and throughout the entire kingdom, which stretched, I understand, from Arabia to India. And this lavish feast, where he displayed all his wealth and perhaps his military weaponry and his pompous splendor, lasted for 180 days. That's a half a year. After that, he threw a stag party in which the lavishness is described in such detail I don't have time to review it. You can see it in the first chapter. And in which the drinking must have been fantastic. Even the king himself got so high by the end of the seventh day of drinking that he commanded the people in charge of his harem to bring out the queen, who was renowned for her beauty, so that he could show her beauty, and of course the queen of a harem was never seen by anyone else, to the rest of the stag party. The queen, in the meantime, had thrown her own party. And when she received this order, as you well know, she refused to go. Well, that threw consternation into this stag party, and the king himself was furious and asked his advisors, his top seven most trusted men, what he should do. And the advisors immediately said, something has to be done because the queen has not only done this wrong against you, but against all of the men and all of the people in our nation. And if this word gets out to the women, they will all become disobedient and insubordinate to their men. Therefore, we need to send out an edict as follows. The queen is deposed, and all women must honor their husbands. And this was sent out on this magnificent communication system in the Persian Empire, and soon everybody knew about it. Well, once the king woke up from his inebriation, he became aware of the fact of what he had done, and he was minus his queen. Well, his pages suggested to him that he have a nationwide, we would call it beauty contest. And so the most beautiful women of all the land were searched for and brought to Susa. That brings in the next important character of our story. Mordecai, a Jew, lived in Susa. And the third character is brought in because he has a cousin who must have been quite a bit younger than he, whom he had adopted when the parents died, and he had raised her. And she was a very lovely and a beautiful young virgin, and so she too was drafted. She soon displayed by her beauty and probably also by her winsomeness an attractiveness to the man who was in charge of this entire operation, and won her favor so that she was quickly advanced beyond most of the others and was, you might say, among the last contenders. And consequently, she was immediately sent to the beautifying school, which lasts a year, something like 6 months anointment with myrrh and 6 months anointment with other spices.
And finally, when it was her time to step before the queen, before the king, she was permitted to take in whatever she wanted to. And she, interestingly enough, only took in what this master of ceremonies suggested she take in. In other words, you might say she went in with her own stuff, with her own beauty, but also with her own charm and intelligence and everything else that she brought with her. And as you know, probably, the person who won this beauty contest was not Scheherazade, as it is in the 1001 Nights, but Queen Esther. And then she did become queen, and the king made a lavish banquet. And, starts all over again. No, this is not... let's see, what's the word I want? What was that joke last night? It's not a boat story. No. Meanwhile, back on the farm, meanwhile, back at the palace, there is court intrigue. And a couple of the people who are the bodyguards of the king are plotting to kill him. Mordecai, who somehow must be among the courtiers in some way or another, gets wind of this, reports it to Esther, Esther to the king. The king has an investigation made, and the facts prove to be so, and the two men are executed, and this is chronicled in the king's annals at his site. Now, the story continues. Roughly at this time, a certain man by the name of Haman, who will become the villain of the story, is made the prime minister of the land. And Haman is honored above all men by everyone, and everyone must bow down to him by the king's command. Now Mordecai, the Jew, refuses to bow down. And Haman learns about this because it's reported to him, and then observes it himself, and it infuriates him. But he is too much of a man, to talk to Mordecai personally, and decides in consultation with his family and others that what has to be done to deal with this man, of course, is exterminate the whole Jewish people. That's logical. But not knowing just when that should be done, he decides that lots have to be cast for the propitious day so that he has probably the divine approval. The Akkadian word for lots, which then became the Persian word for lots, is Purim. And then he comes to the king with a request that there is a troublesome people in the land who are not profitable for the king, and it would be advantageous if these people were done away with. And in fact, he offers him an enormous amount, a certain thousands of talents of silver. I don't have that figure in my mind. And the king says, you write an edict according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked, and deal with them as you wish on the day that your lots have fallen, which turns out to be, I think, the 13th day of the 12th month of the year. Only I don't accept your bribe. So now the plot is set. And the moment that this word gets out, Mordecai goes into a tremendous mourning. He dresses in sackcloth and ashes. He does not want to appear anywhere in that way anymore. And all the other people do too. Word gets to Esther, who has, by the way, not let it be known that she is Jewish. So for the moment, she has been passing, and no one knows that she is a Jewess. But she sends word to her uncle and guardian Mordecai why the mourning in the sackcloth and ashes. And he sends a message back. The reason is this edict. And he charges his niece or his cousin, Esther, to go to the king and plead for his for her people. She sends back word to Mordecai that she can't do that. The reason that she can't do that is if she goes into the presence of the king at any time other than when he calls for her, he can and will have her executed unless he holds up his wand to her to permit her entrance. No chauvinism in this world, of course. Well, Mordecai sends back word once again, and now there's a quotation which I'd like to read here because it's a very well-known one, an important one, in chapter 4, verse 14. He says, "Think not that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise from the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" So, with that challenge and with that kind of call, Esther reflects on this and sends word out that she will do it, but she asks everyone to go into 3 days of fasting with her. Well, to make the long story short, she enters the king's presence in fear and trembling, dressed in her very best, and the king raises his wand and permits her entry. And in fact, he says to her, "Ask whatever you want. I think something to the effect of half of your king, half of my kingdom, and I would be glad to give it to you." And the queen says, "Most graciously, king, I would like to throw a banquet for you and for Haman." And so she throws a banquet for the king and for Haman, and it's a lovely party, and they have a grand time. And I suppose at one time the king bends over and says, "Well, Esther, my dear queen, what is it that you really want of me?" And at that point, Esther bends back and says, "My dear Xerxes, what I would like of you is to come back tomorrow for another banquet with Haman as your guest." And so the king leaves. And Haman is just delighted, enchanted, that he sits next to the king in the queen's presence. And he goes home, and he's about to just relish in the beauty of all of this with his wife, Zeresh, I think is her name, when he sees Mordecai, and all this delight turns to ashes and dust in his mouth when he thinks of Mordecai. And it's so bad that he may be even getting ulcer kind of feelings. And his wife says, "Well, you've got to do something about that, dear. Why don't you build a gallows for your friend Mordecai?" And so indeed he does build a huge gallows, something like 81 or 75 feet high, I think 50 cubits. And then he feels better. And he's ready for the next banquet. Meanwhile, back on the farm, or I should say, back in the king's bedroom, the king is having insomnia for some strange reason. What does a king do when he has insomnia? What do we theologians do when we have insomnia? Well, we read theology. What does the king do? The king has his court annals read to him. If anything should put him to sleep, that should. My emendation. So they read court annals to him, and just by chance, he happens to come across that part of the annals where a certain Mordecai had saved his life. And aha, I have never done anything to reward that man. And the next morning, he calls in his top man, of course, Haman, and asks him for advice. Haman is flattered that the king calls him in for advice. And he's even more flattered when the king says, "I want to honor someone above all men in my nation. What do you propose I do for him?" And Haman visualizes the Persian counterpart of a ticker tape parade down Fifth Avenue in New York and describes the whole thing with white horses and the works. And Haman just spells it all out, and already has visions. If Haman were this man, he would ride that horse. And, of course, Xerxes turns around and says to Haman, "Let that be done for that person
for Mordecai, who saved my life. And of course, Haman is absolutely crushed and goes home and tells his wife, and she sees that he's crestfallen, and she says, if that's Mordecai, your enemy, you will not prevail against him. And now returning to the main plot of the story. Second banquet. Help me out, because I may not... Did you all hear that? Okay. So he has to lead the way before him and carry it out, in fact. The queen, then at the second banquet, of course, reveals the plot against her people to the king and says, there's someone who wants to exterminate my people. And here she has to reveal that she is a Jewess. But the king at this time is so taken with her, of course, that he is outraged at that fact and wants to know who it is, and she points to Haman. The king is so furious that he walks out of the house and paces back and forth out on the patio. And Haman, needless to say, falls down on the bed of the queen and perhaps even touches her, who knows, embraces her arms, pleading for mercy. At that moment, the king comes back in. What? Assault my queen? And with that, immediately calls for his execution. He is strung up on the very gallows that were originally intended for Mordecai.
So, a servant who points out that Haman just happens to have a gallows in his backyard.
Well, the story isn't over. You know, we're past the fail-safe point, because an edict of the Medes and the Persians has been put in force that on the 13th day of the month of Adar, all the enemies of the people will be put to death. And so now the queen pleads for a further favor of the king, that an edict be sent out, which in effect he cannot retract the edict, but he can countermand it. And the Jewish people are allowed on that day to defend themselves and to take vengeance on their enemies and to plunder their enemies. And so with that, there is much rejoicing among the people, and feasting and celebrating. And when the day comes in the city of Susa, let's see if I have the exact figures. There are 500 people killed, as well as, what is it, the 10 sons of Haman. And throughout the land, there are 75,000 people killed. And because evidently there still are enemies in Susa, the queen asks for a special dispensation for a second day of self-defense, and then of being able to fight back against those who would still try to kill them within the capital city. And so I think another 300 of the enemies of the Jewish people are killed. And then the edict reads, or the people follow the request of the queen, that there be celebrating and fasting and hilarity on the following day. And as a result, there is celebrating and fasting, and hilarity in the nation roundabout on the 14th day of Adar, and in Susa on the 15th day of Adar. That, in effect, is the end of the story. Happy ending. There's a kind of a P.S. at the end of the story where there are several letters written, first by the king, which in a sense was the prior edict, and then a letter by Mordecai, and finally a letter by the queen, all putting in black and white that this celebration should continue for 2 days as forever among Jewish people. And it should be a day of happiness and celebration and feasting. And furthermore, people should give gifts to the poor, and they should exchange gifts with one another. And this should continue always. Okay, that's pretty much the story, and I appreciate the fill-ins that I've received, and I might ask at this point, are there any other details that any of you recall that are of note that we might add here before we take a look at the story as a whole? David?
For me, it was a good example of poetic justice, because the person who wrote the countermanding order was Mordecai, the man who was supposed to be destroyed by this first edict.
Very good. Not only the irony that Haman is hung on his, hoist up on his own petard, but that Mordecai is the one who speaks the edict, writes the edict. Well, what do you think of it? You know, you must read it for yourself. My telling leaves some things to be desired, but it's a fun story, and I think it would be magnificent to enact in a play, a radio drama, perhaps to see in a movie. It has all the makings, I think, of a good story. It has excitement. It has a sense of plot, of intrigue, of suspense. There's lots of irony in the story. It moves along. It's very well paced. One thing is that the people, though we come to like them, we do not get too deeply involved in any of them. We don't get an in-depth look in the people's lives, as we do, for instance, in the story of Ruth and in other biblical books. And perhaps one other thing that might be said about the story itself, we get a kind of stereotyping. A villain is clearly the villain. Esther is the almost unbelievably heroic, perfect queen, something like the heroines in the Shakespearean dramas, the women who are so magnificent, idealized. So we may have some reservations about the story, and yet we sit back and, I think, and delight in it. Perhaps also interesting is the figure of Xerxes, a great, powerful figure and a true figure in Greek history, one of the last great Greek emperors, Persian empires, who's renowned for two things. One is that he couldn't defeat the Greeks, and usually that's all we know about him. The Greeks defeated him at Thermopylae and at Salamis, but he's also known for a great achievement. He built Persepolis, and the ruins of that still exist, and I understand it's still an operative city. Both Susa and Persepolis, incidentally, are in Iran today. Susa in the foothills of the Zagros Mountains, and hence the winter residence, where it will be a little warmer in the winter, and Persepolis, I guess, somewhat higher in the mountains. Well, those are minor details, and I think give us a little bit of feel of the story. In any case, he is an interesting king, a very powerful man, of course, and yet a man who is mastered by wine, who is defied by his queen, and who's ill-advised by his own closest advisors. As one commentator put it, he's in need of a good consort. And he gets one who tells him to do exactly what he wants, what she wants him to do. Another one of the delightful ironies of the story. Well, so much for the level of story at which it's engaging, enchanting, delightful, and interesting. I'd like to push on a little bit and suggest some of the questions which are intriguing about the story. Now, the first one is, what is this book doing in the Bible? And here I'd like to suggest a couple of reasons why there has been evidence of doubt about its being in the Bible for a long time, and yet why, in fact, it still is in the Bible. Our first recorded list of canonical books included, and that's about 200 years into the Common Era, about 100 years after the year 90 AD. That's the time when we generally think of the Jewish canon as pretty well closed. And Esther is listed in a Talmudic list. So that means there was little question that it was in the canon. However, interestingly enough, Esther is the one Old Testament book that's not found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea people, the Essenes, if that's what they were, had their own liturgical calendar, and they did not celebrate Purim.
So that may be one reason why Esther is not there. then a number, and we may wonder why, in fact, that they why they did not include it. Here are some of the reasons that have been given. Many of you know the fact that the name of God is never explicitly mentioned in this story. Another reason is that Esther probably did not follow the dietary laws, because if she went in and went through all of these beautifying procedures and got all the choice parcels, as we're told, as everyone else did, she was not like Daniel, who said, no, we will not eat the diet given to us in this land, but we will eat only our own diet. Another reason that has been suggested is that she didn't immediately go to the assistance of her people, but objected to Mordecai when he asked her to go. Perhaps a further reason why there's been some question about the book in the canon comes from a Christian understanding of it. Christians may have been nervous about it being in the canon because there was some question in Jewish circles for reasons already given. And it's interesting that in many parts of the East, Esther was not in the canon. In the Western churches, it often was, perhaps because they only had translations of the Septuagint, the Greek version, which had six editions, which included the name of God and told quite a bit about the motivation of Esther, and gave information about the letters, which made it a bit more religious and even more historical. But interestingly enough, the Jewish people themselves kept these editions out of the canon. I think there are further reasons why Christians felt uneasy about it. They found it excessively nationalistic and bloodthirsty. And some people suggested it was almost not anti-Semitic, but anti-Gentile. And furthermore, it's not even alluded to in the New Testament. There are no messianic prophecies or hints whatsoever. And in a sense, it lacks some of the most characteristic features of what Christians find in the Old Testament, the sense of God's grace, of forgiveness, of mercy, of reconciliation. So here we have it, some of the main reasons why the book has been called into question. And yet, on the other hand, there it is. What are some of the reasons why it's put in? Well, one is that there is a keen sense of God's providence hovering over the book, safeguarding the life of his people, working through indirect means. And perhaps another minor hint is that fasting did seem to work, and maybe fasting is associated with prayer, even though it wasn't explicitly stated. Now, what I'd like to do at this point is throw the whole discussion over to you and ask you at this point, what do you think of the place of the book in the Bible? Given at least the amount of materials that I've tried to offer here, can you think of reasons now why you feel it might... There is good reason for questioning its canonicity, and why we might say, to bring it to the theme of our day, that this really is a book that's not a part of our story, our Christian story. Or are there some ways in which you feel maybe somehow it indeed is a part of our story, and it rightly is in our canon too? Maybe that's too difficult a question to put out, and maybe you don't want to commit yourself right away.
It reminded me of the Holocaust story, and it was turned around, didn't it?
Yes, you know, I want to push it a bit further with the Holocaust story. I've heard a number of people say how vengeful of the Jews when the Eichmann trial was performed, and when they victimized Eichmann and put him up in that glass cage and made him go through the trial that he did. And I think for many people who saw the story from a distance, it may have seemed
to echo some of the brutality and, let's say, the vengeance of this story. But from a Jewish perspective, the Eichmann story is for them justice. And it's just symbolic justice because 6 million Jews were killed. And so it's just one man who is in a sense symbolic for that. But I really appreciate that tie-in because I think that's one way in which Esther does really relate to today, especially to the whole Holocaust reflection that some of you have been involved in. Any other comment? Okay, now that's an invitation to contextualize this story a little bit, one of our favorite Holden words. We've got to put something into context, a Bible verse, a Bible book. We can't just pull it out of its context and say, here it is. Yes, the Jewish people were put into captivity in the year, 586 by the Babylonians. The Babylonians are overthrown by the Persians. Some 580, 30, 40 years later, around the year 550, and that's when this line of Achaemenian kings has its beginning. And Xerxes is the fourth of these, and the Jews are still in captivity. May I correct myself a little bit? I want to take that back. They're not in captivity, right? Cyrus the Persian, who is, I think, the first or the second of these rulers, has an edict that sends the Jews back home. So they're not in captivity, but many stayed in the what then became known as the diaspora. If we take them as kind of symbolic of the Jewish people, then it does give us a story of God preserving his people, is what you're saying. Yes, I think that's true, and in a sense then the story becomes part of the great motif of Heilsgeschichte, doesn't it? Part of that story of God's people through the ages, with both the special choice of a people and maybe all the also the offense of a chosen people. Any other comments about the story? Or you? One of the important contemporary, at least fairly well-known contemporary Jewish commentators, Robert Cordes, uses that as his basic justification for the whole purpose of the book, that it shows us a story of amazing courage through which God led, helped to preserve the Israel people. And then we might see that as a parallel. To play a little bit devil's advocate with myself here, the story of Judith would be a similar story. I don't know that I can tell you all the details, but Judith is a book in the Apocrypha where we also have a heroic woman who saves her people by doing something like the story of Sisera, which is in the Bible, where the wife of Jael puts a spike through the commandant Sisera after she had put him to bed by giving him milk in her tent. That's a very gruesome story in the book of Judges. Judith, I think, cuts off the head of the commander of the foreign army, the Babylonians, and then that gives the Jewish people courage to come in and defeat the Babylonians. Interestingly enough, Judith is often associated in Jewish lists with Esther, but Judith is in the Apocrypha. So we do have a story of heroism, and much of its thematic is like Esther, and yet it is not in. So what I want to do is keep us a little bit on the griddle that it is a problem. This book in the Old Testament is somewhat problematic because of that, for some people, as I mentioned, why is Xerxes mentioned, I think, 190 times and the name of God not mentioned once? Now, people have tried to offer reasons for this let's see if I can recall. Perhaps it slips my mind now, but there has been a good argument offered by some, but it has not been convincing. Oh yes, here it is. This is a time of feasting and hilarity, and in one of the Talmudic official words, it is said that during this time the men should drink so much wine that they can no longer tell the difference
can no longer distinguish between Mordecai is blessed and Haman is cursed. That's a directive in the Talmud. And that's quite a directive. And so there really is a spirit of hilarity and joy to the point of inebriation. And now the thought was, in that case, if the book were read out loud, we would not want God's name to be defiled by being heard by an inebriated person. Well, no, they had, I don't think it would spoil the fun if I may say that, Dave, but the problem is it would defile the reading of the book, of the sacred name. But the response to this argument is that would be no reason for putting some of the other religious, leaving out so many of the other religious concepts. The covenant is not mentioned, the law is not mentioned, prayer is not mentioned. None of the other Jewish pieties are mentioned. Mark? One of the recent arguments in defense of the book has been exactly in those terms. That is to say, it was put in for liturgical reasons because we have a festival that is not grounded in the first five books of Moses. And there is a statement in the Talmud that refers back to the last verse of Leviticus that says these things should be kept and no other regulations of law. And yet here we have a festival that the Jewish people keep, Purim, which is not in the first five books of Moses, like Passover, the Great Day of Atonement, Rosh Hashanah, New Year, Sukkoth, and so on, Feast of Tabernacles. The problem with that argument, the thing that weakens that argument a little bit, is the fact that Hanukkah is another festival that is not grounded in the first five books of Moses. Hanukkah is grounded out of the book of Daniel, which is a very late book. So that does create another difficulty. But I like a lot what you're saying about the liturgical context. And let me push on to that a little bit, because I think that may be a real clue for us to get a hold of still another way of handling this. And here I'll share with you the name of someone who's been instructive to me. Brevard Childs has written a recent introduction to the Old Testament as Scripture. And he's really stressing not just the historical context, but now a new context for us, what he calls the canonical context. We need to see the book in its canonical context. And he looks especially at the last verses of the book, and notes especially the great emphasis on how the story is kept, how this festival has to be kept, has to be 2 days long. In other words, there's got to be 2 days of celebrating, no longer for the reasons originally stated, but just 2 days. And next of all, it has to be at a certain date, and this is in writing. And furthermore, it said something to the effect that Esther wrote this, that there may be goodwill and peace among all people. So there's an interesting word of reconciliation there. And in the fine print, it's also indicated that they should do this for their lifetime, and that when they do it, they should combine their rejoicing with fasting and mourning. So what Child suggests is that these verses, which many people say are late additions, and often kind of dismiss those last verses, he says they are a very important addition because they put a book that otherwise is maybe somewhat secular and nationalistic in tone into the worship context of the Jewish people. And that means that the book both has a future and in a sense it has a past, namely all the history of the Jewish people. So it does, given the way the words are written now, belong there. And now two little applications. And then let's throw that out for discussion. The one application is that would make this book the strongest statement in the Bible for the religious significance of the Jewish people as an ethnic group. And that's really interesting for us because I think we tend to spiritualize the idea of Israel. I don't know if we're misunderstanding Paul here, but we think of ourselves as the new Israel. And I wonder if we don't think of the Jewish people as no longer Israel at all.
So perhaps Esther helps us rethink the whole question of the chosen people. The other side of the coin might be something like this, that a pure nationalistic understanding of the Jewish people also is losing something, namely, it's stripping the people, Jewish people, from their profoundly religious context and its basis in the whole Old Testament story. Okay, so maybe that's the point at which I'd like to bring the story and the discussion of the story somewhat to an end. I think, in other words, it has some very interesting, pertinent bridges to us today. If I would summarize them, it makes us think anew about the Jewish people as God's people, but it really links the religious context of that statement to the whole Old Testament. And then I think it raises an interesting story that justice in itself, as important as it is, and as important as we need to take it perhaps, justice cannot be the last word. And maybe in that way, Esther points, does that point to the New Testament by raising the question of justice? Is justice enough in our relationships with each other or with another people? Or does there have to be something beyond justice like mercy and grace? Okay, any comments or response on the book of Esther as our story, as well as the Old Testament story, or the story of the Jewish people? You see the hand of God, for example, in this call for such a time as this, or in the king not being able to sleep. Okay, you see, you're seeing a tremendous instance then of providence in this story, not in a dramatic intervention like in the crossing of the Red Sea, but in the quiet workings even of court intrigue and of a Jewish girl in the harem of a king.
Yes, because I believe.
Okay, any other comments to that? Well, the interesting thing here, not to put a shower on our laughter too quickly, but the interesting thing is that it's the Jewish people who take up arms here and do the killing. And many people are, you know, deeply disturbed by that. I must tell you, perhaps as a little PS, that for Jewish people, the very fact of God's providence, which is so evident in Esther, is just what makes the Holocaust so difficult. Because they didn't see his providence when 6 million Jews were killed. And so the very book, Esther, which we can see this way working in our lives, and I know many of us have, and I'll start with myself, experienced, and we'll talk about our lives as really providential happenings again and again. We must know that, let's say, our Jewish brothers, when they look at Esther, they say, looking at Holocaust, where was God? So, once again, Esther is a book, I think, that reverberates to today. The Jewish people do think about that book, and they think about it precisely in that context, and it raises those agonizing questions. There's the bell. Thank you very much.